It's time to talk jazz, and my guest on the phone tonight is an award-winning composer, saxophonist and arranger. He's continued to build a reputation as one of the more creative, exciting and surprising musicians on the Australian music scene. His music has been performed by small jazz groups, rock and pop ensembles, big bands through to chamber orchestras and string quartets. He's performed extensively internationally, and his recognition includes an ARIA nomination, a Winston Churchill Memorial Fellowship, finalist in the Australian Jazz Bell Awards, nominations for the Friedman Jazz Fellowship from the Music Council of Australia, and an Australian Art Music Award for Excellence in Jazz with the trio of Berardi, Foran and Carlin. Raphael Carlin, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thanks for having me on the show, Frank.
Raphael, can we start by finding out a little bit about how you found music as your calling? When did it all start for you, and who were your early influences?
I'm fortunate to come from a musical family. So my father was a beautiful guitarist. My grandmother was a singer, and my great-grandfather was a composer. So as such, I wasn't interested in music at all. I was much more interested in running around outside, shooting slingshots and things like that. So they tried all sorts of instruments to get me hooked onto music when I was young, cello and guitar and piano, and nothing stuck. I wasn't interested. It was only when I was about 13 that I got interested in saxophone. Yeah, thanks to just a good teacher. And I guess it's that age when everyone gets hooked by something. Whether that's sport or girls or boys, whatever that might be. But I found music at that point, and that was great. I jumped in pretty quickly and tried to make up for as much lost time as I could. And yeah, then I was very fortunate to have good teachers moving on from there, which just makes a world of difference.
You grew up in Queensland, didn't you? Is that right?
Yes. So I was born in Stockholm in Sweden, and we moved when I was very young to southeast Queensland, a beautiful mountain called Tamarind Mountain. So hence why it's beautiful running around outside shooting slingshots and just hanging out. And then I moved to Brisbane to study at the Queensland Conservatorium. And at that time, it was the wonderful saxophonist Tony Hobbs was the teacher there, which was perfect because I was able to work on my composition at that time as well. He was a wonderful composer and arranger, so I could. I started writing for big bands at that time, and I was just very interested in different. I enjoyed playing straight ahead jazz and some key figures of that time. I mean, I loved listening to Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane and Jan Garbarek and Joe Henderson, and quite a good. They're all amazing, but I realized that I wasn't really a bebop player. It wasn't my bag. There were just people who were better at it and cared more about it, and it just didn't feel like authentic to me. It felt a little bit imported, I guess, from what I needed. It was an interesting one, being a Swedish-born musician growing up in Australia, learning music and studying records from all around the world. And so, just trying to find your place in all that was a good challenge. I'm still trying to find it. But, it's nice bringing in everything you care about and trying to find ways to make it your own.
Would it be fair to say that your major influences are composers rather than tenor saxophonists, for example, or musicians, for that matter?
That's a good question.
Instrumentalists.
I think I really liked composing because then I would have a lot of control about what I wanted to hear, and it felt like it was me in a different way. Like it felt like I could play. It's easier to find your own voice on your piece than trying to play giant steps and sound like yourself as opposed to everyone else who's played giant steps really well. So from that point of view, I found it much easier to be myself if I controlled the environment to my strength, which was not being virtuosic and athletic saxophone. I mean, I love the saxophone, and obviously spent a lot of time. That's my thing. But the writing for different ensembles freed up my playing as well. Just finding different ways to integrate an improvising musician like myself, or some wonderful musicians I've been fortunate to work with, like Steve Newcomb or Andrea Keller recently. Just incredible players, and setting up environments for that is stimulating, because then you can kind of curate an environment where you want to hopefully ignite some spark from the performer in an unexpected way.
Now, you're about to launch a brand new album, I believe, called Equally True.
Yes, that's right. This is a quintet album that was recorded a few years ago. It was meant to be toured in 2020, but the world had other plans. Something got in the way, you know, had to reschedule. Then it was meant to happen in 2021, and then something got in the way again. It's been an interesting one because the album featured Kristen Bradie on voice, Matt McMahon on piano, Brett Hurst on bass, and Simon Barker on drums. All incredible musicians. So I'm having a great time. The music was written to showcase just what I really like about these musicians and just how they bring so much openness to the music and so much space to whatever they play. So I was trying to find the balance between providing an opportunity for them to leave their fingerprint on the music and inject themselves into it. So not being prescriptive, but being hopefully somewhat suggestive about what direction I'd like it to go, but not keeping them on too tight a leash. So the music started from that point of view, and natural that the music changes, you know, even from performance to performance. It's really fun because you never know what's going to happen. They're all such consummate performers, so it can go in any direction, and everyone will support whichever way it goes. And no, I'm really learning a lot. It's such a pleasure.
Raphael, if you weren't a musician, what profession do you think you would have pursued?
That's a good question. So about 10 years ago, I started getting into photography, and that was really fun, but more so just analog photography. I really like that process where there's a discreteness to it. What you shoot is kind of, yeah, I mean, you're very limited with the amount of frames you have and what you can do. So there's a nice closure to that I really like, where you kind of have to accept things and work within those parameters. I guess that's something I'm really enjoying right now. But I don't think I'd be a very good photographer to actually make money. So as a job, I don't think I'd be very successful. But I really enjoy the process. But something creative, I think, would definitely be on the horizon. I don't think it would be I'd do very well in a 9-to-5 job. I do like teaching, though, so I guess that's happening concurrently.
Yeah, it's almost a prerequisite for musicians these days, especially in Australia, to double up as a teacher as well. COVID had some lasting effects on society everywhere, all around the world, not just from a health perspective, but also things like changing the way we work, you know, the flexible working week, working from home, things like that. What do you see are the significant effects or changes to the performing arts as a result of COVID?
Well, I guess it's kind of unhinged a few, or unhinged sounds negative, but it's lifted the anchor of a few different things. Now you're, I guess, freer to look sideways in some ways. Different. I mean, the income streams have been so varied and confusing for a long time anyway, so it's just become even more of a labyrinth. But I think people have become much more resourceful in thinking, how can you share your craft? How can you share your music and hopefully reach people, but also make a living in some shape out of it? It is, yeah, it's hard. It's such a shifting landscape. So it's, I think we'll be seeing where things land. I know I was reading a few different versions of different ways, because there's the streamed performance thing. It's a weird platform. It's a hard one to connect with. And if you don't have the right setup, but it can be beautiful. But the question is, you know, will people continue to consume music through a virtual performance? Because it is hard when you're not in the space. There's something very magical about being in the room with performers and experiencing something that won't happen again in the same way. And yeah, it's great to be able to reach more people and share that. I don't know. I think the hybrid's nice, where you can have the live streamed gigs, but people are in the room as well. Like, it's very hard performing to an empty room with a video camera. I didn't enjoy that too much.
CDs seem to be making somewhat of a comeback to a degree. There's quite significant costs in producing what we call vinyl and streaming. Yeah. Well, you've already touched on the limited returns that you can get from streaming. What do you think the outlook actually is? Where is this all going to land? I mean, there has to be a format to consume music on an ongoing basis if you're a jazz fan.
Yeah, so I've heard a few things which are optimistic, which I'd like to focus on those ones. One is saying people will appreciate, just like, you know, there's a return to vinyl in some way, like people will ideally, I'm very optimistic about this, but appreciate finer things like a concert. And when there is scarcity in that way, then you can kind of appreciate what it can bring. It's like, there's a craft to it, and I think that by not having it, we're all poorer. It's just like if an art gallery is not there, then we're not. You can't consume it in the same way off a screen. But you know, when you're standing in front of a painting, it can be very powerful. I do like to think that the people will be hungry for it, and will always be hungry for it, and will realize that they're missing it more and more. The other one, I remember reading that if it's easier to pay for music. So if things become more integrated, I mean, it's becoming like that more now anyway, but I remember a few years ago, before everything was as instantaneous as it is now, if you could, you know, listen to something and just push button to buy, which I know it's kind of there, but it's so much easier just to be on Spotify and let it roll on, or Pandora, or whatever, wherever you might be. But that money might not find its way to the artist. So there are influential people trying to make a case for, you know, the money finding its way to the performers, but it is the system isn't geared like that at the moment. So there are a few things that need to change for it to happen. But I like the live thing. I think that's special. And you mentioned before about the streaming, recording things for future broadcast. I was fortunate earlier this year to work with the Australian Digital Concert Hall. And it's a bit of that model where you spend quite a bit of time making preparing for one really nice concert, and it gets recorded very well, audio and video, and that's nice. Then it's a thing, because if it's lo-fi, then it can feel a little bit substandard. It's hard to be like, yo, check this out. Here's a video I recorded on my iPhone. Like, which can also be great now, but you know what I mean. Like, it's a different thing when you have professional videographers and technicians. They can get a really beautiful product, and I think there's definitely room for that, and that's a complementary thing which, yeah, we can definitely explore more of.
Well, speaking of your crafts, obviously at the top of the interview we mentioned you're a composer, a performer, live performer, and a recording artist. What do you enjoy most out of those three?
Yeah, I they're all stimulating. I think I have a slightly short attention span, so I like digging into lots of things, and then I get interested in the next thing and dig into that. So the more I write, the more I want to play, the more I play, the more I miss writing. And then arranging was a fun one too, because then there's a different headspace as well, where you're trying to fit into something else. But yeah, I think they all feed into each other, and they keep it nice and a bit more alive for me, because then you kind of bring in new things and you explore them on one side, and then bleeds into the other side, and then they kind of, yeah, they inform each other. I remember asking one teacher I had who was very inspired by in England, and he was super open-minded. He was one of those people who would be he was a professor, so he was a very well-respected academic, and was super out there with his compositions, would be really open-minded with new music. But he also performed early music really, really well. And I was just confused how he could have these different personas across, you know, academia, really contemporary, like out there, contemporary classical or Western art music, and like Renaissance music. And he was saying when he went to university, because of the University of Illinois, and, you know, John Cage was popping around here and there, and there were just no walls. You just kind of do what you wanted to do. And that was really helpful for me. And so I've been trying to approach it like that, where we don't need to be too precious about how we, not necessarily how we present things. We should do things properly, but we can, things influence us. And as long as we're transparent and respectful where they come from and how we use them, or how we engage with them, I should say, then I think that's a positive thing. So that kind of affects how I approach my composition and my saxophone playing, I think.
We're going to go out with a piece called The Promise of Postcards. Raphael, can you tell us briefly a little bit about the inspiration for this one?
Absolutely. So this piece was part of a suite that I composed. It was originally commissioned by Lynette Irwin, who is a wonderful human being and an incredible force for generating or supporting music in Australia. And I feel very lucky that she gave me opportunities to compose for openings of a few Brisbane International Jazz Festivals. And this was one of those pieces that I was commissioned for the Brisbane International Jazz Festival. And the suite was called Arrivals and Prospects. It had four movements. And I wanted to try to unravel the concept of looking forward and looking backwards, and how each of those can have different starting points and different being charged with very, very different feelings. So you can look forward with excitement of a future prospect. So those arrivals and prospects. You can be, yeah, really excited about a future destination. Or you could, on the opposite side of that, you could be quite anxious and nervous and trepidatious and just not fantastically positive feelings about what the future might bring. And then they're the same conversely, looking backwards, so, you know, looking backwards with a nice warm nostalgia and all the feelings that go along with that, or getting stuck in a bit of a rut and things become stale and you ruminate too much. So I worked with a songwriter to generate the lyrics, which I then set. So they're the only four tracks on the album that have words, and the rest of the compositions use the voice as another instrument, and they're the vocalese. But this one, The Promise of Postcards, is about looking forward. It's not the darkest one. It's on the album, but it is looking forward with a little bit, you know, trepidation and how you're a bit scared about what the future might bring. It's still quite gentle. The whole album is quite gentle. There's intensity, but it's quite subtle. And this is, features a really nice Kristen solos first and then Matt from memory. So this one has lyrics and it's a little about looking forward with a little bit of tension to a future destination.
Raphael Carlin, thanks very much for joining us in the studio.
Appreciate it.